Okay, folks, so let's dive in. Hopefully we've been slightly warmed by the exercise earlier, or if you know, were a bit too knackered to do that, then grab the questions off of Akasa Jyoti, because she's got them. And because hopefully that is touching in our spirit. So we're moving today into the red right, and you might have noticed a bit of a pink redness, orangeness, but redness basically. And Amitayus, interestingly, you're talking about light, Amitayus, the Buddha of infinite light. Amitabha's already on our shrine. So, can you hear me, Leslie?
Yes.
Okay, good. Can you hear me?
It's only when you lean down.
I might be leaning down. Okay. Right, okay, so the red right, let's just kind of dive in. And what I'm hoping is that you might be able to pull some threads from it, but it might spark other threads. So run with whatever comes alive for you. Do you see what I mean? I mean, just going to try and evoke it and then just do what you need to do with it. So the red rite, the rite of fascination, the origins of this is love magic. Okay. So if you wanted someone to fall in love with you, you know, you'd involve spells and potions and try and draw that person to you. And then Vajrayana sort of used this energy, a really powerful force in life, which is to fall in love, very, very powerful energy, sort of said we can use the rite of fascination, what draws us in, to draw us more deeply into the qualities of enlightenment, to draw us, to unfold our potentials much more deeply. So these rites are just allowing us to kind of find different ways of working with our energy to take us towards our goal. So this rite of fascination takes us into the rich world of our relationships, I'm sure all of them do, and it's through sort of deepening our awareness of almost the, if we're looking at the tantric rites in relation to spiritual friendship, the near and far enemies, just to kind of look at what can disguise itself for the rite of fascination, what we're really trying to move towards, and also bear in mind kind of like the sublimity, is that a word? Mm-hmm. How sublime the goal is. Yeah. So it's to try and kind of bring both of them to mind, really. And in tantric Buddhism, kurukura, have I said it right? Kurukura. Today's a name for words. Anyway, she's represents the red rite of fascination, and she's a form of red Tara. So we've got the beautiful green Tara right up by the tarp. We can just imagine it in different colours and forms. So she's very, very red, and her beauty is quite hypnotic, and it magnetises. And she dances wild in the cremation ground, wearing bones. She's naked, attractive, and draws all beings to her with her irresistible allure. So she's an archetypal image that represents insight springing up from great compassion. And she has flowery weapons, especially a flowery bow with which she fires love arrows into the hearts of beings, causing them to fall in love with the Dharma. And in a way, she represents our truest longing, our longing for the Dharma. So when I was thinking about this rite, Kurukura didn't instantly come to mind, to be honest. Who really came to mind was the Buddha. So generally on each morning on retreat, mostly at Tivatna Loka, we chant the Tivatna Vandana. And Sachimuni's been sort of read out the Buddha Vandana the other day, read out the Dharma Vandana today. Some of those descriptions of the Buddha really evoke in me that kind of longing. It's a real pull. I find it quite fascinating when I'm not going through the motions and when I'm actually sort of bringing to mind the qualities of the Buddha. So thinking about this, really, the Buddha came to mind. And this rite of fascination, what it's trying to do is just trying to engage us much more deeply on an emotional level to draw us towards the goal. So the exercise that we did a little bit earlier was about how it feels like when we're wholly engaged, that sort of absorption, and something else can generally end up coming into being. So I've got a bit of a wordy quote by Bante, so make of it what you will. So Bante says, "The central problem of the spiritual life is not static but dynamic. Not so much a matter of intellectual understanding of this and that doctrine, but of the concentration of our total psychic energy. And since," he says, "this energy is nothing but the energy of desire in the widest possible sense of the word, and since emotion is only the long-circuiting of desire, it is with the concentration and sublimation of desire and the reorientation of energy that the spiritual life is above all else concerned." So it's how we can kind of galvanize almost the whole of ourselves, galvanize our energies in the direction of what we really, really want to be moving towards. And hopefully I'll be able to evoke that a bit. So when I was thinking about transforming our energies, at reorientating them, what came to mind, was the Buddha. But also what came to mind was the story of Varkali. Also because it's a favourite story of mine. And I've got, you know, it sort of speaks to me because I'm a bit like that. Do you know what I mean? So anyway, some of you might know the story of Varkali. So Varkali was a young Brahmin man living in the city of Shravasti. Have I said that right?
Shravasti.
Lovely. And one day he kind of comes across the Buddha, possibly the Buddha's on his arms round, and he's completely entranced by the Buddha, becomes a bit besotted, and ends up thinking, I want to be as close to this man as possible. So basically the qualities of an enlightened being are highly magnetizing. So the Buddha was accused of drawing away men and women from their homes by some sort of spell. So the quality of it's just fascinating to reflect on the qualities of the enlightened mind. People just felt really drawn to his beauty and radiance. And I imagine that is like the Dharma shining through, really, him being the Dharma. So Varkali falls in love with the Buddha and wants to be as close to the Buddha as possible. So he becomes a monk and he spends his time, apparently, just as close to the Buddha as he can, staring at the Buddha. Apparently, one of the stories is he stares at the Buddha unblinkingly, but just keeps gazing at him, apart from obviously going on his arms around and going to eat food. I'm very much like Varkali, actually. So what can happen, you know, when you get into a connection with people, we stir up very strong emotional energies, hopefully some very strong positive emotional energies. But what can end up happening is we can end up sort of slightly falling in love. And I don't know about you might be in love right now. So the experience of love, it can consume you. It can pull you in all sorts of directions. And it can be quite a kind of a blissful kind of experience. And I don't know about you, but that kind of intensity of it doesn't last in a way. And Konza sort of talks about a concealed suffering. Whatever you have, you fear losing it. So even in that kind of the pull of, that extreme desire, kind of craving, there can be a thread of dukkha in it as well. So we're just sort of thinking Varkali is not an exception. How many people have sort of fallen in love on retreat? Someone's sort of qualities are shining through. Suddenly you see a person in a completely different light. Subhuti, in a list of talks that he sort of drew out about the tantric rites and friendship, said the near enemy of this rite of fascination can be a falling in love, a sticky kind of attachment. And I wanted to sort of share, when I first met, Vajratara spoke about Ratnadharani yesterday, quite a moving story. I hadn't heard that actually. I was very, very touched by what you shared actually. When I first met Ratnadharani, I don't think I realised at the time, but I did slightly fall in love with her. If any of you kind of know her, she holds herself in a very kind of upright way. It's a bit like her practice really shines through for me anyway, for quite a lot of people. And also she's very beautiful. Yeah, she's got a shaved head. possibly a bit masculine, who knows? Anyway, maybe not. happened was, you know, when you kind of get really entranced by someone, you notice everything that they do. So what I sort of realized when I was on retreat, I sort of knew if she was in the shrine room or not. There was this just kind of constant slight looking out. And from how she made offerings, really aware of how she saluted the shrine and how she made offerings. So just to sort of say that this falling in love doesn't have to be sexual, because I didn't have sexual feelings towards her, but it was quite a confusing time because I'd never felt those emotions for anyone apart from kind of like a sexual partner. But something really interesting happened. Quite a few of us were kind of quite smitten by her. I remember someone being a bit more smitten than me, so I probably didn't act it out. I really was, but I tried to be a bit cool as well. But someone else, they, in my mind, they weren't that cool. And they were kind of quite openly smitten. And when I sort of saw how they kind of related to her in that way, I just thought, oh no, I've got to stop it. Like, I've got to stop that. And I'll come on to a bit why. So basically, the Buddha notices Barkali staring at him, gazing at him as much as possible. And he goes up and he tries to speak to Barkali and basically says, Barkali, what are you looking at? This is just skin and bones. It's the Dharma. He sort of says, why do you stare at the skin and bone, this foul body? We're talking about body movements this morning. Anyway, and he just kind of encourages him to really practice the Dharma. And then he goes to him again and tries to encourage him and just says, Barkali, he who sees the Dharma sees me, and he who sees me sees the Dharma. So again, kind of keeps trying to encourage him. It doesn't quite work, and the Buddha has to kind of send him away so that he can really kind of touch his real potential, you know, which apparently he does gain a level of insight, so that does kind of work. So reflecting on this rite of fascination and kind of reflecting a bit upon myself as a way of kind of, yeah, encouraging you to do the same, the rite of fascination is associated with the archetype of the lover. So in friendships, this desire for intimacy and connectedness can kind of spill over into this kind of pema, this kind of sticky attachment where you kind of want something kind of from the other person, maybe in not such a helpful way. And for me, how it can kind of play out a bit was like, it wasn't just that I was a bit besotted with Ratnadharani, I wanted to be her. Do you know what I mean? So actually, if I'm really drawn to someone, like... Chandra Prabhu is my KM, and she's got an ever so subtle Irish lilt, and I have to really watch that I don't start slightly speaking like her, because I just find it so beautiful, you know. So it's not that a bad thing, but I'll come on to kind of like, yeah, the near and far enemies. So what can happen is that we can really be drawn to someone, really be kind of magnetized to them, but at some point or other we'll hit up against a bit of difficulty. So it might be that the spell starts to wear a bit thin. It might be that we've projected a lot onto this person, a lot of qualities and also a lot of expectations. I know that obviously Ratnadharani could see it would happen. So we'd be talking and then she'd just share a time where she was grumpy. And I'd just think, oh, like, I definitely didn't want to really hear that. So I wouldn't let that kind of go in. I didn't want to. You know, there's something about not relating to her really as another human being. So the near enemy of falling in love is we can have quite unrealistic expectations. And the real danger of putting someone on a very high pedestal is at some point that might topple, or we might topple it. The love bubble might burst. And that can end up in a bit of disappointment and resentment. It's not that this is a bad thing. It's just that these are sort of working grounds. So the romantic myth is strong. There might be the sense of, like, this isn't really my spiritual friend. This isn't really working. This isn't really my ideal in a way. Maybe my needs aren't really being met. And it might not be that the other person has changed. It might be that they've been themselves all along, but we just kind of see more of them, really. So the shadow type of this archetype of the lover, so the shadow type of the archetype of the lover, is that there can just be an addiction to this kind of degree of intensity. Yeah, wanting kind of a degree of intensity. And then when that's not met in some way, we might end up just trying to move on. So what it is, it's a looking out of ourselves for the bits that are missing. So it can just be a real pull towards the world to kind of feel something. And there can be a kind of lostness to the lover. We go from kind of one to another. So maybe there's a real fear of intimacy. Or possibly another side, or sort of passive side of the shadow archetype of the lover, might be like the wounded lover. So based on past relationships, maybe based on past experiences, there can be a real fear of strong emotion, a real fear of being kind of consumed by the other person. So we have this kind of sense of not wanting to get too close, maybe because of the fear of abandonment in the past experience. So the near enemy of this rite of fascination, so the far enemy of this rite of fascination can be a fear of strong emotion, a repulsion, maybe even an authority projection. And when I was sort of reflecting on this, is it a Michael Jackson song saying, "I'm a lover, not a fighter"? Is that one of someone's song? Anyway, and it can be like the opposite of that kind of attraction, really wanting to be like them, is that kind of slightly going to war, pushing them away. And again, we might need to do that on our journey. It's just trying to bring these tendencies more and more into awareness. And just kind of reflecting upon these near and far enemies, or what enemies might be a bit of a strong word, but maybe these near and far kind of obstacles or calls to respond in another way. There was a quote by Bante that said, "The sad truth is that it's far less troublesome to indulge in ecstasies of love and admiration for some bloodless abstraction like humanity than it is to love for one moment sincerely, unselfishly, above all practically, even a single imperfect human being with their unreasonable demands, suspicions, little misunderstandings, petty jealousies." So sort of thinking when we explore this right for ourselves, it can be really helpful to kind of explore specific friendships with the potential for unfolding metta or just love within them. So it's a bit like, you know, we can, and I think it is really important to care about humanity. I think it's really important to care about the environment, and it's also really important to care about the person just beside you, your friend beside you. So I thought that was a good point to make. So somewhere along the line, if this archetype of the lover is very strong for us, and it might not be, it might be one of the other rites kind of pulls us more strongly, that we need to transform this push and pull, because that's in a way what's going on. Bante talks about the craving to unite or the craving to pull away. So we need to kind of transform this push and pull, wanting and having, in a way to bolster up ourselves in some way, the positively or negatively. So from wanting to be loved into actually loving. So to going from our fantasies about someone to a real human connection, and that will involve them and us with our faults and our failings. So this rite of fascination, what I've been thinking about, is that in order to establish real spiritual friendship, we really need to cultivate metta or maitri. So without that, we might not fully have an understanding, really, of the beauty of the goal. And it's likely that some element from our conditioning, some of the anusayas or our samskaras of dysfunctioning or codependency might arise. So reflecting upon this rite of fascination, I just wanted to, I'm sure metta is an important quality for a lot of us, but I just really wanted to make a plug for metta, because reflecting on this rite of fascination, what we're kind of working with, I was thinking particularly, or what I've particularly kind of worked with, is an aspect of craving. So the romantic myth has been particularly kind of strong in my life and probably remains still quite a strong pull. So when I first went on retreat, at some point on retreat, the retreat would bite. And I would just get into this complete fantasy about getting married, regardless of whether I was in a relationship or not. And it would be kind of quite consuming. And there's nothing wrong with getting married, and there's nothing wrong with that. So please don't hear any of that in that way, because, you know, someone might, that's not what it's about. But what ended up happening, actually, on one of those retreats at Tara Loka was I was reflecting upon the qualities of the Buddha, and maybe we were doing a guided meditation, it was a bit of a time ago. It was a bit like the Buddha came to me, and it's very hard to know with these communications. There is a communication, isn't there? But I can't tell you whether it was in words or not, but I can only communicate it to you in words, really. And it was a bit as if the Buddha came to me and sort of said, look, even if you find the perfect partner, you will not erase dukkha from yourself or the world. It was a bit like, even if I kind of found someone to fill me completely, that wouldn't be the answer. And it was a shock. I mean, probably shouldn't have been a shock, but actually it came as a bit of a, you know, when something goes really deeply. So it came as a bit of a... Yeah, it's a bit of a shock. And I think what can happen if there is an over-focus on, for myself particularly, on my partner wanting to communicate with them, it can be a real barrier for taking our friendship sort of deeper. And we can end up sort of Maitri Metta love not coming to fruition in a certain sort of way if it's driven up by craving and identity designed to sort of merge with the other person. Actually, funny enough, when I was at the Buddha Field Festival 2 years ago, explored Untangling the Tangle, where the Buddha talks about one of the driving forces. The Vajratara was talking about the wheel of life and trying to stop the wheel of life. So one bit of the wheel of life is craving. And the Buddha talks about craving in three ways as karma tanha, the sense kind of getting caught in sense pleasures. Bhava tanha, that sort of desire to be, and vibhava tanha, that desire not to be. And that really plays out in our relationships. And I think it can particularly play out in all the rites, but particularly in this rite of fascination. So I was sort of thinking what the metta bhavana has sort of done for me has been to really sort of cultivate this sort of chaitanya, this directionality of mind, sort of becoming much more aware on where I sort of place my attention and how I work with desire. So I think in a way I've really tried to work on purifying wanting attention from men in a particular sort of way. So it's funny, isn't it? Our conditioning kind of plays out. So I had a very absent father, you know, and so I haven't really sort of had a father figure in my life, and I sort of gravitated towards beings that might kind of embody that, to somehow sort of live that out. So I sort of wanted kind of approval or kind of affirmation in a certain sort of way from men. And it is sort of, I feel really grateful in a way to have kind of come across, the Sangha, come across women really wanting to befriend me in a way that has allowed for an intimacy. So there's nothing wrong with intimacy with guys. Please don't hear it in any, you know, there's nothing wrong in that. But there's been something really important about kind of purifying that, about how I magnetize beings towards me, how I draw people towards me. Because we all try and do that. There is something about belonging and love that we all need as human beings. And how we go about that can kind of reinforce ourselves in a way that might not be that helpful, might be quite limited. And I think actually just my love for women, because of my own conditioning, has just grown much more deeply, that I'm much more aware of people in their relationships, and if there's a woman there and there's a guy there, how I respond. And that kind of just deep desire for metta to kind of not do harm, and I feel really grateful for that. And I think there was something about the metta practice and coming more deeply into relationship with myself. And I'm sure for all of us, has sort of changed my relationship with the world. It's really allowed me to kind of embrace friendship and intimacy in a different way. And that's not to say I don't appreciate guys and I'm in a relationship, you know. So I was thinking in particular what the Metta Bhavana sort of helped me to do. And I think it's this guy, Ken... My devices have died. I came with this really old computer and I thought it would last, but the cold, I think, and it being old, sort of drained the battery. So anyway, I think it's something like Ken McDodd. He sort of was talking about this, and I could relate it to my Metta Bhavana practice in terms of the lakshanas. So he, so he sort of talks about it. And for me, I was thinking about how the Metta Bhavana practice has particularly helped me. It's been a stop trying to survive. So it's something about cultivating an ability to turn, that practice of metta, being able to cultivate an ability to turn towards, metta being that desire to turn towards whatever's arising, whether that's kind of an inner poverty, an inner lack, and notice the flow, because sometimes when we're trying to survive, and I definitely have been in phases of my life where that's been the case, but it's not like you're permanently surviving. There are moments towards the day, there's this continual, actually I think we had a team meeting and Sia, she said, there's this continual contraction and expansion, and I've often felt that in the metta practice where our experience is constantly changing. So he equated that stop trying to survive with the lakshana of impermanence. And stop trying to get your emotional needs met. And he equated that to dukkha. So that doesn't mean it's not okay to have needs, and we do have needs. So I'm going to sort of talk a bit about the first stage of the metta. But in that kind of hungry ghost way, hungry ghost realm, so Amitabha, we had a sort of red Tara. Amitabha is associated... with the red rite of fascination, when we're trying to kind of purify this desire to connect out of lack, out of a kind of inner poverty. So he's associated with the hungry ghost realms, where whatever you get isn't enough. Yeah, so it's that sort of stop trying to get your needs met in a way that just can kind of feel like not enough. And he associated with that with the lakshana of dukkha. And the third one was stop trying to be someone. You know, so Vajratara sort of pulled out yesterday the three forms of conceit in which we can kind of shore ourselves up. So that sense of inferiority that, well, I'm no one, or, you know, we can look up to someone, but from that sense of, oh, they're so great, I want to be them because being me isn't okay. Or the other kind of sense where we can kind of go to arms or what have you, get into competitiveness with someone else. So we kind of... the conceit of feeling superior to someone else, or even that sense of kind of equality. We sort of want to bring down the ideal in some way, that we're all kind of equal. And there is kind of a, or there can be, and it's up to us to kind of see a hierarchy of who we think embodies those qualities more. It's not for someone else to come and say, oh, I embody the, you know, it's for us. We hammer that out in kind of dialogue. So anyway, stop trying to be someone. And that is the lakshana of insubstantiality. So when I was when that kind of came up, I sort of thought, oh, the Metta Bhavana practice, really kind of cultivating and exploring the first stage of the Metta Bhavana. It's exploring those pushes and pulls, those ways in which I try and shore myself up. And I can definitely feel the fruits of that of that, because it's sort of from loving ourselves that we can also really be in connection with someone else. So I've really been appreciating our walking meditation, and particularly the oak tree. So we sort of stand round the oak tree, and you know, when you just have these senses of something just going that little bit deeper. So we're sort of staring at the oak tree, and there's all of us kind of staring at the oak tree. And sometimes I can feel connected doing that, and sometimes I definitely can't, you know. But that morning, there was a poem that you'd read around commitment as well. That morning, I just really felt then it was something a bit as if what that oak tree kind of symbolised was the trunk was that of metta. It was almost like from the strong foundations of metta and self-love can we really come into connection with others. And the connections of others were those kind of branches. And at some point in the metta bhavana practice, the trunk and the branches, they're still all the tree. You know, it's all connectedness or something like that. Anyways, it was quite a lovely experience of that, actually. So how to kind of work a bit with this rite of fascination, how to work with this push and pulls. What I wanted to give another plug for was a Brahma Vihara's retreat. So you can kind of use the near enemies. So the Brahma Viharas, these sublime abodes, which I think this rite of fascination, how we kind of really get into what love really is, what our connectedness really is, which is what the Buddha was kind of imploring Vakali to do, which was to kind of really see the truth. Really see deeply into interconnectedness as well. He who sees me sees the Dharma, sees the truth, and an aspect of that truth is just our deep interconnectedness. So I was sort of thinking with Ratnagarini, what I needed to do in order to transform that kind of sticky Pema of really just wanting to be like her, how I sort of tried to kind of work with that. So you can work with Pema through Karuna. So the four sublime abodes are Metta Karuna, which is compassion, Mudita, which is sympathetic joy, and Equanimity, which is Upekkha. So basically what I really needed to do was sort of... So there's this thing of if you make someone more than human, you can reduce their humanity, which is a weird thing to think of, isn't it? So I needed to kind of see her. I needed to take in some of the times where she was really trying to say to me, oh yeah, I get grumpy. I just didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to take that in. So it's a bit as if we can see someone, you know, like you see different parts of someone as they're walking down the flight of stairs. If you're up the stairs, you can kind of either see bits of their head, body going down. And it's something about we need to see the whole of people in order also to see the whole of ourselves. You know, that is that quality of the importance of spiritual friendship, activating things in us. So I really needed to kind of be able to open to her dukkha as well. You know, to see her sorrows, to see her humanity really. But what can kind of happen, and what has happened at times in my peer friendships in particular, is that I've needed to. So there's the quality of what I've been working with, particularly with this rite of fascination, is I can definitely really want to move towards someone, but there can be this barrier, this far, no further. There can definitely be that barrier that comes up. And I've definitely felt that much more in peer friendships. So Bhante kind of pulls out the importance of vertical friendships, but also peer friendships. And how I really tried to work with that is through mudita. So it's a bit as if with my elders, there are difficulties I just don't want to see. But with my peers, sometimes it's a bit like, you know, in GFR groups, all I could see was a bit of difficulties. Vajrasakhi said, one of her sisters said, how can I soar with the eagles when I'm down here with the turkeys? So what can kind of happen is actually that not wanting to sometimes get too close can be a kind of fixing someone with those kind of difficulties. They can become a bit that kind of horrified anxiety. So the near enemy of Karuna is horrified anxiety, and in a way how we work with that is mudita. So they're much more than that. Our friend that, falls in love or is blind to their... you know, vertical friendship, blind to someone's kind of faults. They've, you know, I've got other qualities as well. So it's trying to kind of see each other in our breadth and depth, which can kind of help with this craving and pushing and pulling away that's subtly happening all the time. And but what can happen with mudita is can be like the near enemy of mudita is this kind of vicarious enjoyment, a kind of vicarious enjoyment. My mind's gone blank on that moment. Sort of like a real my making. So someone else is delight. We don't just see the beauty of their kind of delight. There's a stickiness of, oh, well, at least it's my friend that, you know, so it's an ego clinging can kind of come in. We can kind of suck the pleasure out of someone else's delight. How we work with the near enemy of mudita, which is vicarious enjoyment, is through equanimity. So in a way that, yeah, so equanimity is just becoming bigger. Bigger to hold it all, the joys and sorrows, the delight. So it's not that we don't feel it, but the pushes and pulls allow us, allow the mysteries of reality to kind of reveal themselves. And that's what happens sometimes in the beauty of a communication in our friendship with each other. Something bigger than the sum of its parts comes into being. That's what I hope is happening, and sounds like it's definitely happening on this retreat. But again, the near enemy of equanimity is indifference, where actually you think you're being really equanimous, but actually you're not really caring that much. You know, you're not near enough, you know, to kind of feel that push and pull and come into something bigger. So it brings us back to metta, you know. So I wanted to just kind of highlight that. And, I think that the metta bhavana practice is a really revolutionary practice. And Vegetarian, you were sort of saying that there's these three aspects, sort of metta with reference to beings, metta with reference to dharma, and objectless metta. Sort of really coming back to the importance of being able to be in connection with ourselves, which allows us to be in contact with the rich blessings that we are deeply loved, not just by our friends, but hopefully we might open to the blessings of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, that kind of imaginative realm as well. So basically, I think the metta bhavana and friendships, obviously, because they've brought out working grounds, my inner life is much less impoverished. Actually, I have a much richer inner life, and I've definitely tried to cultivate the Brahma Viharas. So basically, we need metta, this turning towards and seeing kind of almost like with kindly eyes, to really allow a deeper beauty to unfold, the beauty of reality. Everything is trying to sort of reveal its secrets. And that's a bit the rice of fascination for me. So I'm going to move on to... what am I going to move on to? I'm going to move on to sort of saying what has really made a difference of kind of working with too close or not close enough in order to kind of open out to a deeper love has been sort of helped my inner life. This has been a communication. So Bhante, you know, in the puja we say, may our communication with one another be sangha. I remember I was sort of thinking, like, what's that? You know, you sort of, it rolls off, doesn't it? Yay, may it be sangha. But what does that actually kind of mean? You know, how do we really share our life with each other in order to really change and transform? So I needed to speak with people about having fallen in love with Ratnadharani. Like, I needed to sort of share that experience. So if you do fall in love a bit with someone who really exemplifies qualities for you, I'd possibly encourage you not to just tell, not to share that with them. I mean, you could, but it might be worth first just talking to a good friend, you know, because we can end up fixing it in a certain sort of way. And it was just really helpful to talk about it with my friends because... they were able to say, oh yeah, I had that experience, and it's not quite love in that Pema way. It wasn't quite that, you know.
Yes, it can be really helpful to kind of talk about it. And actually, I did end up saying to Ratnadarini, so we had this time together, and I can share two examples. The reason for working a bit with intoxication is when I first hung out with Ratnadarini, I was beside myself. I was so excited that she'd asked me out for this walk. So in our groups, we were sort of talking about, well, you know, we have these things of how we try and connect with each other, and, you know, we go on these walks together, and I was beside myself. I was, yeah, I was uncontainable. So I was with her, and I was like that, you know, sort of like, so we need, you know, metta practice allows us to hold ourselves as well. And I just sort of blurted this thing out. I just said, oh, you know, I'm so excited you asked me for this walk, because, you know, if someone were to look at you, you can seem quite scary. And I think what it is it's your glasses. Your glasses are a bit thick, and it makes your eyes look small. And that can make you look a bit scary. But you're not at all. You're actually really, really lovely. So basically, I'm sort of sharing this example because we can communicate things. You know, there's something about authentically being ourselves. But sometimes that authenticity is like this fleeting mental state kind of comes in. And we share that, and intoxicated states, this kind of Pema falling in love and really being ourselves, doesn't necessarily take the other person into account. Mm-hmm. But Ratnadarini has been unfailingly kind to me, so she just held that, and she just went, I gave a talk somewhere, and I asked for some feedback. And interestingly, when I asked for feedback, I meant feedback on the talk, but they gave me some personal feedback about my appearance. And she sort of just kind of diffused the whole thing. She sort of kind of, I think she sort of saw what was going on for me and still managed to communicate. But when I finished that walk, you know, so Amitabha holds the hri, so the seed syllable hri, to kind of blush. When I came back off of that walk, I actually just felt kind of a bit of shame around that. That kind of intoxicate, the kind of Pema means that we might not meet someone else. That has been a touchstone experience as well, of kind of, because I can get extremely intoxicated and lose touch with my body and try and come a bit more from my depths. But anyway, another conversation with her, poor woman, was so what we put our friends through, hey, was I was walking along, and you know, I just thought, oh, I just need to tell her. So I just said to her, Ratnadarini, I just need to tell you, I'm not in love with you anymore. And luckily, again, she just kind of held that in her stride, and she just went, that was my name, Anona, you're a very strong woman. And then I was like, I'm a very strong woman. Anyway, what that did was it completely took me off track around what I was. But anyway, so this quality of what we can do for each other is also kind of, kind of meet each other. But I think what sort of happened in my relationship with her was that what I was saying, even though it was kind of mental, I had strong feelings of metta towards her. So there's something about, which dovetails us on, where are we, kindly speech, priyavadata. One of the Sanghavastus. So there's something about our communication with one another. This what does it mean, male communication, be sangha? This kind of, I think Vajratara was talking about this vital mutual responsiveness, vital, because actually it's that red lifeblood, being able to kind of share our experiences, even if it's really clunky, even if it's a bit naive and ill-formed, it's kind of vital to life. But what we're trying to cultivate, and that possibly just has come with time with me, is that mutuality. So priyavadita, that kindly speech, it's speech with love. It means really taking in the other person. So it can only be kindly speech in a way if we really have a sense of the other person. And we can often only really have a sense of the other person through communication, through really asking how they are, through really, really being interested. So And I think this kind of quality of speech, the speech unites the head and the heart, reason and emotion to we try and unify it through our communication or clarify it through our communication. So learning to speak with love, learning to speak what we really need to share, and also doing that from the basis of metta is quite central to the spiritual life, really. And there was this beautiful example of this. So on the setup, I think it was the closing ritual which Diyajyoti led, or the ritual before the closing ritual, which the day before, which was rejoicing. So I came on that day, and people who'd been on the support team gathered round. So we were here. We were in this shrine room. Gathered round, and I thought, I'm just going to sit and hear people rejoicing in each other. And people looked knackered. Satchamuni looked exhausted. And it was like people, it felt like, this it might have been my projection, people had like dragged themselves to this session. But as people started to rejoice in each other, like, everyone came to life. All of a sudden, like Satchamuni, from my perception of her looking knackered, looked radiant, you know. And there was something that was just brought into being, and I just sort of thought, oh yeah, of course it's a means of unification, because we are drawing out qualities. And what it sort of reminded me of, at Bante's funeral, Subhuti sort of talked about Bante. What is it, Rajatar, that the mystic union of the historical and the divine? So there's something in us that has the touch of the transcendental already, or sort of already has that longing, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And there's like the messy parts, but in that moment, that kind of kindly speech that was rejoicing in the best of each person, what they'd seen, created an atmosphere that allowed something much deeper to come into being. It was almost like a dropping of any kind of subtle masks or persona, anything. And that was kind of like touched almost some sort of sense of real humanity. It just allowed this deeper love to come into being. So folks, so kindly speech, just to say, it does include truthfulness to it. I don't think that atmosphere could have come into being if it was frivolous speech or just kind of like a plucking of qualities from the sky. I think it was a deep seeing of people that allowed something else to come into being. So this kindly speech, so as I was saying, I've experienced a lot of kindness from Ratnadharani. And her witnessing of my potential, which has allowed something else to come into being. So we need each other to kind of witness each other. And there's this lovely kind of little quote, and I'm going to be just rounding up. So this is from Trogul Chumpa, which says, talking about the right. The symbol of the enlightened Padma family is the lotus, which grows and blooms in the mud, yet still comes out pure and clean. So Padma neurosis is connected with passion, a grasping quality and a desire to possess. We are completely wrapped in desire and only want to seduce the world without concern for real communication. But when the Padma neurosis is transmuted, it comes fantastically precise and aware. It turns into tremendous interest and inquisitiveness. Everything is seen in its own distinct way, with its own particular qualities and characteristics. And it talks about this Padma wisdom as being discriminating awareness. So the beauty and love, where there's no room for ego. Folks, so just to kind of round up. So the rite of fascination. Bante sort of says the longing is of two kinds. So we often talk about it as karma chanda and dharma chanda.
So in The Problem of Desire, which is a really great thing to read around crossing the stream, he sort of talks about desire as craving, and that Dharmachandra is desire as aspiration, that there is also naturally a deeper longing and yearning in us. And that yearning is to kind of go beyond ourselves. And we can feel that in our communication. So while we're sort of slightly a bit in the mud, what can kind of help take us out of it is trying to come a bit more from our depths. And I think that that has definitely been a bit of a practice for me, particularly in line with my conditioning. So it's not necessarily that my conditioning or... I'm half Indian, so I lived quite a bit of my time in India. It's not that truth didn't have value, but privacy, sort of secrecy, there was also something like it's okay if no one knows. There was, you know, sort of where I was, or particularly in my family, that kind of context, not to kind of label, you know, another culture or something like that, but it was... there was something about really needing to kind of find out what the truth was for myself, and the basis of metta really allowed me to be able to kind of do that in relation to my friends. Subhante talks about tapping into this longing can open us to something that goes beyond ourselves, and we can feel that in communication. Kindly communication can be a doorway into that, particularly on the basis of kind of ethics as well. And he calls this Maharaga. So in Mahayana, Maha is kind of purifies. Maha, I think Vajratara said, sort of takes us into Shunyata. So Maharaga is great passion that kind of encompasses that quality of an open dimension, openness of being. And he sort of says there's this great love that is this Maharaga, this transcendental passion, this uninterrupted stream of positive feeling that flows from the heart of enlightenment in the direction of all beings. That's a bit what we're trying to evoke with this rite of fascination. And I wanted to share just one example. So a clunky meeting again with Ratnadharani. So we were meeting again at this kind of, this 2 o'clock slot. So we met, you know, so just to say, folks, I came from a really small sort of situation where I had two Dharmacharinis, and sorry to say, they didn't really get on. Yeah. So I didn't really have a cooler because they didn't really want to come together. They're great beings, by the way, but they didn't really want to come together because that wasn't going to work. Yeah, so what kind of happened for me was I really just tried to deepen in a way my peer friendships, and there was one person that I was more closer to out of the two-person dynamic. So deepen my friendship with them. But predominantly, my deepest experience was on retreats where I really got into communication, got to meet kind of different people. So so sometimes, you know, when we're exploring spiritual friendship and we can feel in a bit of a, for some of us in an isolated situation, it can be a bit like, oh, how might this ever happen? How might I deepen connections enough? But it does end up happening. And, you know, these connections do end up kind of forming at least with a few people. So my centre of gravity, in a way, was a bit, was my centre as well, but was also T. Ratnaloka. There were some people that I formed some really deep connections with, and Ratnadharani was one of them in particular. Anyway, so we were meeting at this turning circle. But just to say, I met her twice a year for 2 weeks, and I'd write to her, and she'd reply every 3 or 4 months. But because there was just this space, I'd just write anyway. So sometimes I'd be writing even before I got a response, and I'd be like, writing sometimes into the ether. But you might want to explore, yeah, in your groups where desire goes to faith. Anyway, so I was meeting with her, and she, not with her, meeting with someone else, but she was there, and she had these envelopes. And I thought, I know, I'll post them for her. So, and if any of you know, Ratnadharani is fiercely independent. Like, she doesn't need you to do much for her, and doesn't necessarily appreciate that either. So, but I didn't know. So I was waiting there. She was waiting there, going to meet someone. I saw these envelopes, and I was like, I'll do that for you. she looked at me slightly horrified, you know, by the thought of that. And in that moment, I just sort of saw and I thought, oh, she doesn't need me to do that for her. She just doesn't need that. So I was just kind of looking at her, taking her in. And then, and she was just looking at me, and then this kind of, she wasn't so horrified. She just sort of saw, oh, something, there was some sort of communication that went beyond words. Yeah. And in that moment, I felt like I had a glimpse of this kind of, this great love. It was a bit like there was just connection. There wasn't me and there wasn't her. It was sort of this glimpse of this kind of like objectless matter. You know, there was just connection. So just sort of saying what this kind of takes us into is a bit, Bhante sort of says that only those who are truly desireless know how to love. And in universal love lies the secret of liberation. So a bit like when we get beyond this push and pull and come out into a much greater love, which is a practice, obviously, and we do it in various ways, we open to a much greater love. And that's, yeah, the love of the Buddhas. So anyway, folks, that's it.